This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville. We're actually going to go for a very sort of low-impact, quiet start to this particular show, because it deals specifically with notions of media, and particularly the relationship between media and technology. This is always a very, very difficult hand to play live in a studio. There's music playing, there's love and volcanic ash in the air. I know that because I have a bad case of conjunctivitis as a direct consequence of this. Howsoever, welcome indeed. Welcome, traveller, to Hollingsville, in which a TV awaits you in every room. During the course of this series of programmes, I'll be examining different aspects of our relationship with technology in the company of specially invited guests and composers. Now, it seems to me that when I speak of a relationship with technology that we enjoy, there will be some who will say that actually our existence is so intricately and so intimately involved with technology that to speak of having a relationship with it is a bit like saying that one has a relationship with one's central nervous system, or that we have a relationship with the air that we breathe. And it's for this reason that I think media is a very, very good point to continue this examination of our Radio Expo of humanity, technology, and the future. And when I put those three words together, the incident that always immediately springs to mind is the publication in January 1996 of a special issue of Wired magazine, still a little bouncing baby publication back then, dedicated entirely to the life, ideas, and thoughts of Marshall McLuhan. There was a very comprehensive overview of his career. There was a whole section celebrating his collaboration with the designer Quentin Fuhr for the mass market paperback book, The Medium is the Massage, copies of which seemed to turn up in Oxfam shops endlessly throughout the 70s and 80s and almost into the 90s. And there was also an absolutely fantastic interview with McLuhan discussing how his theories had altered to accommodate the new digital regime that was coming into existence. And he really was in terrific form. He promoted the idea that inefficiency was really important to modern business. He dismissed the cyberpunks as a bunch of sentimentalists. He spoke about how the product now actually promotes the consumer, and was generally in terrific, insightful form for someone who'd actually been dead for 15 years. Today, in this digital regime, we're kind of used to these kind of intrusions from beyond. After all, it was only last summer that if visits to YouTube were to be believed, the one person who took the death of Michael Jackson the hardest, and in fact the most personally, was Adolf Hitler. So the notion of people suddenly appearing out of the past, suddenly repositioning themselves in relation to our present through digital media, we've kind of got used to it. But what made this particular gesture, I think, so fascinating, even coming back to it so many years later, is that it also exploited the fact that at the time of his death, which showed a certain whimsy in its timing, he actually died on the 31st of December 1980, so I'm not sure whether that means he was at the beginning of the end of a decade or the end of the beginning of a new decade, but at that particular moment, he was, relative to his status, to his standing in the 1960s, when he was a phenomenally popular figure, you know, he would appear on the cover of Time magazine, would have cartoons about him in the New Yorker, would be quoted in Newsweek, etc., was sought out by political campaigners and advertising executives to sort of sit at his feet. By the end, he was pretty much forgotten. He was pretty much sort of overlooked. His media center had been dismantled at Toronto University. A lot of his books were out of print. More importantly, a lot of his ideas were beginning to be held up to question or even ridicule. There was the possibility that perhaps, you know, his ideas hadn't been that precise. They hadn't actually played out. There was the notion also that perhaps he was not everything that it was claimed of him. That in fact, you know, behind this kind of radical media theorist was a deeply religious thinker, a politically conservative, old-fashioned type of tweed-encrusted academic. More importantly of all, and probably the most damning of all, there was the suggestion that perhaps he hadn't entirely been serious in the expression or recounting of his ideas, that perhaps he was having a bit of a laugh at the public's expense. And I think this is, I don't think you can ever say a more damning thing to the serious student, to the true believer, than that the subject of their study, of their belief, has in fact been having a bit of a laugh up his tweed sleeve all this time. So, to me, I go back to this interview, and in a sense, McLuhan himself, or rather the digital version of McLuhan himself, gives them a very good account of why he's able to present himself in the way that he does. When he's asked about cyberspace, the digital regime, emails, etc., he makes this very, very interesting remark. He says, "The real message of media today is ubiquity. It is no longer something we do, but something we are part of. It confronts us as if from the outside with all the sensory experience of the history of humanity. It is as if we have amputated not our eyes or our ears, but ourselves, and then established a total prosthesis, an automaton, in our place." The total automaton, the completely amputated self, perhaps doesn't seem so alien a concept today. If it challenges us at all, it challenges us, I think, to go back and look at some of McLuhan's original ideas, and probably the most important one for me, the easiest to grasp, beyond the notion of the global village, beyond the flashcard mantra of the medium is the message. There is, plain and simple, the cover of his best-known book, the 1964 collection of essays, Understanding Media. And with it, its subtitle, probably the most interesting part of the book, I think. It says, Understanding Media, the Extensions of Man. That in itself almost forms what he would have called a probe or a percept. You know, there's actual tension between the two parts of this title. Understanding Media is itself a parody of the title of a book on poetry criticism that was extremely popular in academic circles in the late 1950s, early 1960s. So he's already sort of sending up a particular notion about how one analyzes a text, almost flagging up the fact that we have to analyze his title in a similar way. As to the subtitle, The Extensions of Man, this is actually borrowed from the writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson, an essay he wrote in 1870 called Works and Days. And I think if ever we assemble a library for machines, for robots to contemplate their origins, their history, their development, probably one of the first texts they're going to read is Emerson's Works and Days. And this is pretty much the opening statement. The human body is the magazine of inventions, the patent office, where are the models from which every hint was taken. All the tools and engines of Earth are only extensions of its limbs and senses. There we have it, the extensions of man. The idea was not only developed by McLuhan. We find it also in the writings of Norbert Wiener, where he began to talk about the cybernetic networks as being an extension of the nervous system. This extension of the self forms, as McLuhan would say, an environment of services. In other words, it offers us ease, access, new perceptions, etc. And as a result, disappears into our environment, so we no longer notice it. And I think this is a key element at the moment, particularly when we consider how volcanic ash has just actually altered our environment and exposed, in a sense, how plane travel itself is a form of communication, communications medium, and reminds me that one of my guests actually couldn't be with us today. Gary Latchman is, in fact, who should have flown in from Florida earlier this week, is actually still sort of moping around the Epcot Center, waiting for service to be resumed. In his place we have Richard Thomas, Resonance FM's own voice of passionate intellectual debate, who's graciously consented to take Gary's place. And sitting next to him, we have Russell Davies, one of those minds that today, in these circumstances, in this time, is harder and harder to define. Russell Davies, columnist, facilitator, observer, a man of interests, a man of concerns and hobbies. Both of them will be joining me in my conversational hamster ball in a little while, just as soon as we take a short musical commercial break, courtesy of Hollingsville resident composer Graham Massey.
Now, the way a television commercial begins, in other words, what you see first on the screen, is very important. It's either interesting enough to make you want to see the whole commercial, or it's disinteresting to you, doesn't hold you, and you're off to the refrigerator for another beer. Well, some of the most beautiful artwork ever put on film is in the falling leaves sequence of this next commercial. The purpose of this spot is to remind the folks watching it that autumn is the time to change spark plugs for the winter months ahead. The mood of the picture moves from warm autumn colors to wintry blues and whites, when the driving public will want fast cold weather starts. Then the hot reds and oranges associated with AC fire ring spark plugs take over, and we start to sell in earnest. You'll notice that the product sequence is consistent with the first commercial we heard, because there's a great story to be told for ACs, and we're going to hit it hard and consistently. Les Baxter's beautiful musical score sets the mood as we move from autumn to winter in Falling Leaves. And there you are, a sample of the great-selling effort AC is putting behind the spark plug and oil filter campaigns for this season. Along with your cooperation and selling drive, we all stand to make 1963 the biggest year yet. I know that it is AC's sincere hope and expectation that these selling efforts will prove helpful in moving all lines of products and consequently result in greater profits for you.
Now that is a voice. You have to hear that voice over headphones. That guy makes me feel like a bunny rabbit on helium by comparison. Where is the authority these days? Where's it gone? It certainly disappeared from this side of the room, I can tell you. This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville, and one of my main guests this evening to discuss media, the extensions of God, is... You almost make me want to say God now. It's actually Russell Davies, observer, columnist, facilitator, and organizer of some of the most fascinating events I've had the pleasure of attending. Russell, welcome.
Hello.
When I think of interesting, the events that you've organized over here, what the immediate thought to me is that it's actually a fantastically low-key, low-tech affair. You know, there's bunting hanging in the hall. It's a little bit like being at some kind of intellectual gymkhana. The only thing missing is a sort of cranky PA system. You even have a tea urn. People bring their own mugs. And at the heart of that, you have people who, for limited periods of time, anything from 2 to 20 minutes, are allowed to talk about something that really interests them that isn't their job. And I can't remember when I've had that much fun in a hall with a group of people I don't know as an interesting event. How did you arrive at this formula?
Accident and theft. I'd seen the TED events, the sort of legendary and odd and sinister in some ways. TED things, and they did 20-minute talks, and 20 minutes seemed like a very good amount of time to get people to talk. I subsequently think it's way too long, but that seemed a good amount of time. And I'd actually saved up enough money to go. I'd been 1 year paid for by my job, and then I quit that job and had saved up enough money to go, and which is quite a lot of money. It's expensive, and it's flying to Monterey. And it just occurred to me, just as I was about to book the ticket, actually, I could use that money and just organise my own. So did that. And with the intention that if no one came and I was the only person in the audience, it would have been worth it, spending that money. To the point, I mean, you're right, it does feel very low key, but it probably would have been impossible 5 years ago. It's been made possible by the internet, by social technologies, by being able to organise the ticketing for free on Eventbrite, by being able to... All the speakers, almost exclusively, are people that I've come to meet online. To a large extent, the inspiration to do it was these were people I wanted to meet. You know, I'd read their blogs or whatever it was. I'm too shy to just email them and say, hey, you seem a nice person, let's talk. So I wanted an excuse to meet them. So I did interesting.
So I really like this idea of that rather than going to meet people, rather than sort of enter the normal channels of communication with the outside world, you actually just brought it all to you at the Conway Hall.
Yes. I mean, it's entirely selfish, to be honest. I always say I'm not interested in people's feedback. After the event, it's for me. And if other people enjoy it, that's great. And that's why it's cheap as well. I mean, I'd love to make money from it, but I keep it cheap so that if it's no good, no one can complain. And again, I think that helps set expectations. The very first year, we had the people from the hall came and said there were loads of flight cases in the corridor and it was a fire risk and we had to move them and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I just got on stage and said, we need to move these flight cases. Can everyone help? And, you know, 30 seconds later, they were moved. And I think if they'd all paid 200 quid and blah, 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 no one would have done that. So and because it's Saturday, I think it makes a difference as well. It's not just people escaping work. They actively have to choose to come.
I have to say, when I've looked at presentations from TED online, I actually get a bit of a headache after a while. I actually find them quite intense, aggressive almost. And part of me is going, am I looking at the future now? Is this the future? Is this what's going to be happening? I don't know. I've forgotten what they're saying now. Whereas, you know, I can go to Interesting and someone will have rigged up a robot that will blow bubbles every time. In this case, it was Interesting 09, gets a tweet. And I kind of like that dimension that we actually have a piece of sort of interactive technology sitting at the side of the stage. The guy who devised it would occasionally just add extra bubble mix. And it would just start blowing bubbles again. And it was always kind of interesting. I thought, this is how I like information. As you say, I mean, the feedback, I don't really care what anyone's tweeting about what was going on, but I did actually like the fact that, you know, you had a stream of bubbles appearing from the side of the stage.
Yes, and to be honest, I think a lot of it is accident, and I got very lucky. Someone gave us some bunting the first year, and we put the bunting up, and suddenly it felt right, and it felt a bit like the Festival of Britain. And the Conway Hall is a brilliant place. It feels right. And my only intervention from then on is not to mess with it. It sort of worked really well, and every year you sort of tempted to do something different and, you know, try and improve it. And I always come down to, no, let's not improve it. It seems to work. Always try and make it easier every year. Just do less.
Have you ever considered maybe doing like a whole day that didn't involve laptops?
Well, we didn't. Again, the first year I got very lucky. Someone was going to sponsor the Wi-Fi for us. But they wanted me to write something about why they should, and I couldn't be asked. So we didn't have any Wi-Fi, and it just meant everyone paid attention. I mean, it's quite a geeky crowd, and when we initially said there's no Wi-Fi, they were a bit grumpy. But after half an hour, they realised, actually, I can just sit in a room and pay attention to the person speaking, and that's good. I'm not sure there's enough people in the world who can hold your attention without some sort of visual aid to say to people, no, you can't do it. Because it's not just for the audience, it's also for the speaker. I think a lot of people have learned how to present that way. We've had the odd person who's just turned up and talked, and they have been really good, but it's a high-risk strategy, I always think.
Well, maybe we could compromise. Maybe just, like, not do PowerPoint one year.
PowerPoint is just a series of images. You know, there's nothing wrong with a series of images.
I don't agree. I think PowerPoint actually brings, you know, this is a classic case of the medium being apparent in its effect, that it actually produces a particular kind of delivery. That sometimes is actually synchronized. You say it's just a series of images, but you actually end up being synchronized to those images. I tried to use it once, and what I actually wanted to do was just have like a carousel running all the time.
We can do that.
I found it incredibly hard to do that.
You're just obviously not very good at it, Ken.
I'm obviously not very good at it. Richard.
Hello.
Yes,
good evening.
Stop writing.
No, I'm just making notes. Just an aid memoir beneath me. Yes.
Conversation with images. You're a radio man. How does that all fit together, sir?
Well, it's an incredibly visual medium, isn't it, radio? But going back to TED Talks and public performative lectures and so on, I personally don't like them. I mean, from time to time, universities permit me to come in and talk to their students and so on. And I really don't like it. I don't mind an overhead projector because I think it's quite a nice piece of antique technology, but not very useful. But I think it gets in the way. I find that it gets in the way of what it is you're trying to communicate, and I still have this kind of nagging thing that, okay, I've got to click this bit, and I'm distracted, and I stop actually communicating visually with the audience themselves and so on. But in terms of radio, as I said, I think radio is an incredibly visual medium because of its sheer absence of images. I'm not against the visual image. I'm very interested in cinema. I have eyes. I often take photographs and so on. But, I certainly believe that it isn't necessary to communicate a point. But it depends, doesn't it? Some people need it as a support mechanism, a life support mechanism, I guess, when they're there. It gives them something to fiddle with. I find it a distraction. But, you know.
The thing I've found it does particularly interesting is it's a tool for people to be able to get up and talk. And otherwise, but frankly, other than Interesting, I don't go to that kind of thing because I find the people who are normally capable of standing up and talking boring because they're good at it. You know, they're just, you know, the kind of people who will happily sit down and write a 60-minute talk. I'm not really interested in what they're going to say.
How scripted are people?
I imagine for the most part they sort of rehearse what they're going to say, but they've only got 5 minutes.
It's only 5 minutes.
Or 10 minutes, maybe.
Right,
you know.
Right.
And they normally, we normally encourage people to talk about things that they've never talked about before. You know, these people who probably present professionally quite a lot, but we ask them to talk about something else. And you can see quite often they're surprised by what they're saying. They kind of had it planned, but you know, the unexpected things happen.
Really? And, do tell.
Well, no, I mean, nothing dramatic, but you can just, you see them saying things that they didn't quite think they were going to say. And it's because, again, I've never really thought about this before, but actually I think I agree with myself, that what something like PowerPoint actually does is cue up. Right, talk about this topic for a minute or 40 seconds, then talk about this, then talk about this. Without the kind of what I find even more artificial thing of a script or of notes, you know, where people not engaging in eye contact with you and you may as well just read the thing that they've done. Whereas PowerPoint creates, or those kinds of things, create a different dynamic where it also lets... I find it for a longer talk, it also means you don't have to pay attention all the time. And it's incredibly hard to pay attention to someone just standing and speaking. I mean, and people will decry that and say that's, you know, the state of the world, but it's just true. And if you can not pay attention for 30 seconds and look at what they've got on the screen or something like that and then retune in, that's probably more natural, actually, than having to strain to pay attention. That's why I never went to any lectures, probably, at college.
I think it's interesting you use the word natural because, you know, when one looks at the sort of like the progress of media, and I think it's interesting that the first time that McLuhan uses the formula, the medium is the message, is in 1957, and he's actually addressing radio workers who are worried that the growth of the television audience is going to take care of their jobs for them. They're not going to have a job as a result of television, as if somehow radio was going to sort of atrophy and just die off, you know, like, you know, as if they were the equivalent of the village blacksmith seeing the Model T Ford coming down the lane and thinking, right, that's it, I better start updating my CV now. And McLuhan was making the statement to actually reassure them, to actually say, well, you know, actually, you're going to be fine because, you know, as each new medium comes along, it contains the one before it. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that process of containment is it becomes art. You know, it actually becomes a sort of, it will change, but it doesn't go away. And so for me, I think it's very interesting that we've been talking not really about how in something like interesting, you know, television co-opts radio or radio co-opts speech. That hasn't happened at all. In fact, in a strange kind of way, speech is coming back more alive than ever before.
Yes.
And that, you know, in a sense, interesting, and that's the thing I do find fascinating, is watching people go off script, watching people kind of... even those moments when the laptops don't work. I mean, one of the reasons why I was saying, well, maybe you shouldn't have the laptops is because last year I emceed for a quarter of the show, and I could understand now why you really need the MCs, because you've got to have something happening on stage while people sort of like peer at their laptops and the audience, you know, not that entertained by watching an arrow moving around a screen, clicking on icons for 5-10 minutes. So I actually found that process really interesting because there's no way you can rehearse for that. There's no way you can prepare for that. All you have is this sense of, well, we've just got to keep this show going somehow, you know.
Yes, I think it's a bit like saying, you know, I like orchestras, but can we manage without the instruments? You know, it's kind of there, that's part of how those things are. It's not like public lectures, you know, that are how, you know, Shaw used to do them, and now they've been, you know, kind of hijacked by laptops. It's like that's the performative thing that people are doing. And when people do it well, that combination of talking and images or video or something is a new and interesting thing, I think. It's not just a devalued lecture somehow.
No, I'll accept that. And yes, I do accept that. And, I was really only sort of floating the idea of PowerPoint and laptops as tools of the devil, really, to sort of see...
But it is the consensus. I mean, it does seem to be. It's broad, you know, there's a massive kind of, you say PowerPoint and people roll their eyes. And I just go, it's a brilliantly flexible tool. It's used really badly, often, you know, presentation software, not necessarily PowerPoint. But it's an incredible tool, especially for getting people who aren't used to talking to stand up and talk.
Speaking of people not used to talking, I think it's time we heard from our sponsors again. Graham Massey, a short commercial interlude.
You've just heard the end sound for 67. Why not turn over the record and listen to the latest in commercial music tracks? And if you need further information, please contact us at our Los Angeles office.
Quality messages, quality products. This is a quality program. This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville. And I have with me in the studio Russell Davies and Richard Thomas. And we are discussing media, the extensions of God. Now, I've just heard something that shocked me, deeply shocked me, that Russell actually hasn't read any Marshall McLuhan, and Richard thinks he may once have had a giveaway copy of it.
No, I certainly have. What have I got? I've got several books by McLuhan, actually, but I'm not an aficionado, no.
Yeah. Ah, playing the Sarah Palin defence there.
Yeah, very.
I thought what I'd do is sort of like take the other side of the subtitle for this program, which is The Extensions of God. We're deliberately brought together McLuhan's subtitle, The Extensions of Man, with Sigmund Freud's description of humanity in the 20th century as a result of being able to see further, hear further, travel faster. He described the condition of humanity as being, you know, as of a god with artificial limbs. And it seemed to me that the artificial limb was the extension. But it's also something that you lose touch with. You know, it's not responding to the environment in the same way. It's actually, to use a McLuhan term, it is amputated. It's a sense that we're no longer using, together with all the others, in the sort of biological relationship with the others, in the sort of normal relationship with the others. How do you think radio has sort of altered the kind of relationship between the senses?
How has it altered the relationship between the senses? I'm not sure if it has altered the relationship between the senses. I think the thing with radio is that one of its charms is that it's a subliminal kind of continuum, and that often what it's able to do is infiltrate spaces and to the point where you forget that it's there almost. I mean, it's a paradoxical thing, isn't it, radio? Because it's an intimate mass medium. It's a very generous medium. I think most radio producers worth their salt should realise that no one is intently listening for the entire duration of a 24/7 broadcast, that you tune in and out of it physically, you know, rather than, I mean, your attention tunes in and out, let alone actually tune in the dial in and out of a particular frequency. I think it's a dematerialized medium, isn't it? And that's probably why it still thrives, despite the sort of how dispersed it's become. You know, so you've got radio-like objects like podcasts and so on, or audio boo and so on. But it seems to blend quite well with contemporary kind of media society.
I mean, it seems to be in terms of something that's delivered digitally. Maybe we could bring Russell into this as well. What I find interesting is that, you know, the televisual, the YouTube version, tends to be very short, very compressed. It's almost the equivalent of someone snapping their fingers in front of your face for, you know, a minute or two. Whereas sort of online radio, I find it fascinating. You visit people or you go to people's workstations and there will be some kind of online radio station playing, and it's just going on in the background and no one's really paying attention to it until, as you say, they tune in. I think it's interesting that we actually use the word tuning in as a metaphor for attention.
Mm.
How does the visual element that you were describing earlier fit in with this?
Well, it's funny. I do think we're not far from needing art directors for radio, just because increasingly radio is being delivered on devices and media with screens, and that's going to become a skill. But there's also what you were saying about kind of the shortness of video and the ongoing sort of nature of audio and radio. I think that's partly just a failure of imagination. James, who's going to be one of your guests next week, mm-hmm. has just started doing some podcasts which are 4 or 5 minutes long, which actually fit in your life really nicely. And are just the gap for going in. I think there's been quite a lot of the stuff that people have taken audio, you know, radio-like stuff and put it online. They've just replicated the time lengths that were hanging around beforehand. Actually, they need to rethink that a little bit.
I mean, that's one of the sad things, in a way, about digitization is fragmentation. It's also one of the strongest things.
Mm.
I think it's also kind of interesting when we think about how much going back almost 20-odd years, is that the CD, the impact it had on kind of musical narratives. You had an LP, you had distinct sides that you would flip to and from. The other thing with digitization, aside from fragmentation of the message, so to speak, or the continuum, is I think the one of the things that's really nice about analog radio, and I don't want to sound like a nostalgic here, but it's one of the things that sort of demarcates it as a unique medium, is the fact that there's a certain element of interaction and serendipity. You tune through it, you can blend between stations and so on. And these things are absent. I really wish you could have a kind of tune-in knob on an iPhone of some kind, even if it's a virtual one. But
I think it's interesting. I mean, for me, when you talk about tuning through radio, the old AM, FM stations, to me, it sort of conjures up sort of childhood memories of listening to it at night. And the thing I particularly liked was when you actually started to lose the signal and it started to sort of like blend over into shash. And occasionally you get foreign call signals and little tones coming through. And I kind of find that radio really fascinating, almost like the idea that conversations themselves can tune out. In terms of format, I think it's interesting you're talking about like a 4 or 5 minute type of radio piece. I remember some years ago for some satellite radio station, I collaborated on a series with Simon James called, which we actually did as audio trading cards, and they were all kind of 3 or 4 minutes each. And the idea was that we'd actually talk about a different piece of new technology or old technology, but treated as if it was new, almost like a sort of newsreel of the time. So we'd tell them about Sputnik or the first computers or something like that. And I actually found that I've loved that format. I think it's really fascinating to do sort of small, intricately, nicely formed things.
I mean, certainly I really love working on trails and things. You've got a 30-second time span. It's like animation because you can suddenly, time changes. You know, you could spend all, you know, certainly a vast portion of a day working on 30 seconds of audio. It's very interesting. But I think one of the problems with compression is, or rather, one of the delights of radio as it currently is, as we understand it, as an analog FM medium, is that it's the duration is a very interesting thing. It kind of lives with you, it kind of cohabits with you. It also permits all those kind of failings of speech and it permits digression and so on, which of course it's very hard to do within the realms of sort of 5 minute sort of chunks and so on.
It feels to me like it should get longer as well as shorter. I remember I lived in the States for a long time and listening to public radio breakfast shows clearly just didn't have the money to have that many guests or that many, so they would spend ages talking about a topic, and it was really nice, the sort of the leisureliness that they had to pursue it. And then you come back and listen to the Today program or something like that, where just as something feels like they're getting to some substance, they have to cut, you know, they cut to something
else. Yes, and I think, of course, with Today, I mean, it's very much informed by, I think, by newspaper practice, but also to a certain extent, radio is influenced by televisual practice these days. You know, you have things, packages, inserts, and so on, which, in a way, I guess, are punctuation devices in order to free up, so you have space to contemplate what you just heard and what you're about to hear, and for those in the studio to cough, use a lavatory, whatever it is. But I think you're right. I mean, certainly here, I've been working on one series for a long time now, along with many other people that contribute, called Edible Landscapes, which is 2 hours of almost nothing. And really what I wanted to achieve was to tune out completely to the point we can't turn off. We're legally obliged at Resonance FM to broadcast constantly. So I wanted to be in a situation where, one, it was almost nothing that you were hearing, so you would get on with something else. But the show really is predicated upon recordings of sort of quotidian, urban and domestic banalities. So the interior of my fridge, or a real-time trip around, I don't know, Hanger Lane gyratory or something like this, which are intrinsically interesting things in a sense. But I think it was the time aspect and the void aspect I was interested in. I think, you know, amusingly enough to me as well, I've made many of the programs under the pseudonym Sven Kiley, which is an anagram of Eve Klein. And I really like stretching that, because you really do stretch people's patience. But then again, you forget that it's on. And that's a delightful kind of moment, then you can kind of instigate a deja vu or something akin to that.
I mean, it's funny, I'd made a note to myself earlier today that thinking about this, what you were saying earlier about the sort of the visual component to radio, and this is quite often bandied about and more established radio programs, you know, that yes, of course, radio is wonderful, the pictures are so good, but it has occurred to me that of late, certainly, you know, broadcast radio is very much turning into just sort of television without the pictures. And then, as you say, we are getting this kind of superficial glancing over a subject and almost kind of pre-packaged responses to events.
And it's funny, I mean, I have to say, with the honourable exception of here, most radio just sounds so similar.
It's very homogenised, isn't it?
Yeah.
It resembles the high street, really.
Yeah, and The one that the show that's always stood out for me is that again American show Radiolab, because it sounds like there's a bunch of people making radio who grew up with computers.
It sounds it's kind of like an adult Sesame Street about science, isn't it? Radiolabs, yes. Are we talking about the same thing from New Jersey?
Yeah. And but it sounds like people who grew up with the art of noise or something, and they think they understand that sound can be played with, whereas. You know, almost everything you hear on the most radio landscape is just—it's sort of artificially natural sounding, and that's again always seemed odd to me that there's so much room to play with sound and so little of it done.
Yeah, you know? I mean, radio certainly when it comes to scripting. I mean, when you script, you have to be a little bit more elliptical. You don't want to script too heavily, unless of course it is for a very tight, specific news item where accuracy is important. It's a poetic medium. It's also a quasi-musical medium. You should really understand how music works, even if you can't tell, you know, B flat from, you know, D sharp. But you have to sort of adopt that kind of listening process, I think, an approach to radio production. It's also actually ripe for experiment and so on. Because seldom do people do. Though saying that, you know, some of the most extraordinary experimental things I've heard are sort of cricket matches broadcast on long waves, which are kind of cagey and dub sports, where essentially it's sort of 90% nothing with a bit of sort of woozy kind of addled banter and the classic and cliched whack of Lever Against Willow. But it's a highly abstract listening environment, particularly, I suppose, if you were listening to it and you weren't an English speaker.
See, for me, the real kind of winner here for me is speech, is dialogue. I think that one of the things that has been, I think, neglected as a form of literature is the conversation, wherever it may meander and over whatever technological hurdles it may have to leap. I find myself more and more fascinated by, if you're talking about the abstract landscape of the conversation itself. That's why, you know, if there's one thing I'm particularly enjoying about doing this show, it's the notion of bringing people together who haven't met before until, you know, 2 minutes before we go on air, and there is no prepared conversation as such. There is just this kind of interesting play, and I guarantee you that as soon as we go off air, there'll be 20 things that, you know, we wish we could have said at the time. And if I could do one thing, it would be to actually probably record the conversations that take place during the interludes, because I always find it really, those conversations are always the ones I want to hear again. I almost feel like we should like tape them and then just play them as a kind of supplement to the podcast or something
like that. Which again has always struck me as a thing that radio stations should do. Given all the bandwidth they've now got online, there should just be a back channel where you hear those other conversations.
Yeah, and a radio appendix is quite a nice idea, isn't it, I think? Yeah.
It's like, you know, I want to hear the conversation that I'm not hearing. That's always more interesting than the one that I am hearing.
Everybody loves the mistakes, don't they, as well?
Yeah.
Well, they're going to love this show, I can tell you.
Yeah, but again, duration. I mean, I think, this probably, not trying to make excuses, but we'd probably really, really, really start to flourish as we become more socially comfortable with each other and so on in this bizarre theatrical space that looks like a kind of cuboid Liam Gillick installation, doesn't it?
Well, indeed it does. But then again, I think discomfort is an important part of the process as well. I mean, this goes back, I think, to interesting, that people aren't necessarily, you know, this is not their usual environment. This is not their subjects that they're passionate about. But actually, passion in itself can create its own awkwardness. It's much easier to discuss something in a dispassionate way, something that you're not that interested in, because you can hold it at arm's length. But to suddenly actually, you know, unleash the beast in that sense about something that you really care about, that I think is a fascinating piece of theatre.
Yes.
In and of itself.
And it's, I mean, I guess part of the connection maybe is that what we do at Interesting is give people literally a stage, but kind of a context in which they can stand up and talk about something that perhaps they wouldn't have talked about before. And sort of, you know, inviting someone to a studio does the same thing. It's kind of, right, here's a place where you're supposed to talk. I suspect one of the things that to go back to media and digital and blah, 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 one of the good things that's doing is creating new places in which you're supposed to talk. You know, it's almost entirely about conversation, you know, blogging, all those things always come back to conversation, to talking in one way or another. And they always fail when they try to be television or, you know, kind of any of those really, those media things which need large bodies of people. When they become more like some people chatting, they always become more interesting again, I think.
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, at the top of the show, I think it's an intimate mass medium. I mean, it's a sort of paradoxical thing, isn't it? Because we are talking to a mass of listeners, but generally we know, and I think it's important when you're broadcasting to sort of visualise you are talking to sort of one individual in particular. There's something comforting as well. I mean, I'm sure most people kind of listen to the shipping forecast late at night, and isn't just because they imagine themselves strapped to some trawler in the North Atlantic, because that can't be too pleasant. But I think it's the very fact that they're not, but the fact that you are having this rapport.
And it's what you were saying about cricket commentary, which always strikes. It's like ambient speech.
Mm.
You know, it does the same things as ambient music, but with the added satisfaction of there are people talking.
Mm.
You know, and it's like sitting in a cafe, and kind of, you know, cup of tea, and there's conversation going on. If the conversation goes away, it feels weird, but you don't have to listen, and that's a nice thing to be able to generate somehow. Mm.
It's very humane, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, it kind of reaches back to I think it was a comment Warhol made about, you know, this, you know, one of the things he liked is in his early youth was just the notion of like two people would just, you know, sit on a porch and just watch the sun go down and talk. And that, you know, he just liked the kind of extended duration of that, and like that nothing happens, nothing special happens. And I guess in a sense, that's what I find fascinating about McLuhan, because I think he explained a medium to itself that was desperate to know what it was. And I think in that case, it was television. I think that you know, it is the most self-regarding of the media, television, because it needs to know what it is instantly, moment after moment after moment. And suddenly there was this kind of tweedy intellectual who was prepared to explain what it was to itself. And it absolutely loved that, you know. And I think it sort of... But what was really fascinating is that in a sort of classic satirical moment, it didn't understand one thing that was being said to it. It completely misunderstood what McLuhan was saying. And in a weird kind of way, his fame, his status, was almost entirely based on how much he was misunderstood. It was all like the less he was understood, the more famous he was.
Well, I have no idea, but I can imagine that to some extent it was just the fact that a tweedy intellectual was prepared to say something about television was enough for television to go, OK, brilliant, put him on.
Yeah, yes. I mean, it was seeking intellectual credibility, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which,
yeah.
You know, is a thing that to some extent happened with the internet.
Yeah, can we just pause for a second and imagine television looking for intellectual credibility at the moment?
Well, the people who make television want to be intellectually credible.
Yeah, and of course, you look at the BBC, the Reithian BBC, the Third Programme and so on. There was some fantastic television from that period. And, of course, largely informed by people who'd been working in radio production. I mean, some of those shows, I forget... I've forgotten the actual name of the programme, but essentially, you know, it's two people sat down smoking pipes talking for about two and a half hours.
That was the 50s.
Yes, exactly.
That's what it was called.
With maybe two cameras set up and one of the cameramen visible, and no one cared.
Mm.
It was perfect.
I'm going to ask Russell, interesting 10. It's happening, yeah?
Yes, I was reminded the other day that I hadn't done anything about it. So, yes, it's going to be October the 9th.
October the 9th. Conway Hall?
Yes.
You're not messing with the formula, Conway?
No.
Excellent.
No, all exactly the same.
Excellent. I'm actually going to leave you with a small thought. This is, you know, this has been bothering me over the years, and we were sort of touching on it then when we were talking about two men smoking pipes and the quality of broadcast television and radio of another age. And it seems to me that the more sophisticated an audience's responses become to a particular medium, the stupider that medium becomes. So I think that, you know, a majority of people kind of understand the mechanics of television. They understand what's going on. They understand, you know, why things are positioned the way they are within schedules, within programmes, etc. And the result is the programmes have just got stupider and stupider. Same thing. I think it's even more marked in cinema. I think people understand the making of cinema much better than they ever did. And the result is we just get movies that are bigger and dumber and louder than they were before. So I think if people actually want quality broadcasting, quality media products, believe everything you see and hear. Don't be sophisticated about it. Don't be analytic. Don't be judgmental. Just believe. You have been listening to episode 2 of Hollingsville. Media, the Extensions of God, featured contributions from guest speakers Russell Davies and Richard Thomas. Musical interludes were by the Hollingsville composer-in-residence Graham Massey. Special thanks go to Indigo Octagon for creating the show's opening and closing themes, plus this episode's background tones. The entire broadcast has been overseen in the studio by Mark Robbins. Tune in next week for episode 3, Machines, History and Hardware, when my guests will be Bruce Woolley and James Bridle. This is Ken Hollings, and this has been a Project Thrust production. Project Thrust, the name you can trust.